Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Well, it's March, and that means March Madness. This weekend, boys and girls basketball teams from all across the state are coming to Anchorage and descending on the Sullivan Arena to see who will prevail as state champions. Whether you or your kid are into basketball, baseball, volleyball, hockey, soccer, or something else, team sports can play a huge part in the lives of children of all ages. So today on the program, we're talking about just that. I'll speak with national and local experts on the topic this hour, and we'll learn about one new high school sport in its rookie stages here in Anchorage. Plus, find out how kids all across the state are sporting with their brains, being competitive and learning while they're at it. That and more this time on Kids These Days. Hi, I'm Shanna Sheehy, host of Kids These Days. Today on the program, we're talking about kids and competitive sports. You can be a part of this conversation. Send your thoughts by email to mail@kidsthesedays.org or go to our website right now and post your comments. It's easy now that all you have to do is have a Facebook account to talk back to us there. So let me introduce today's guests. Michael Josephson is one of the nation's most sought-after and quoted ethicists. He's the founder and president of the Josephson Institute and its Character Counts Project. He also created its Center for Sports Ethics. He's conducted programs for more than 100,000 leaders in government, business, education, sports, law enforcement, journalism, law, and the military. He's been a law professor for 20 years. And Mr. Josephson is also an award-winning radio commentator. And today he joins us by phone from L.A. Thanks so much for being with us, Michael.
It's good to be with you.
And we also have in the studio with me, Gary Matthews. Gary Matthews began his career in education as a music teacher. He taught music after moving to Alaska from Pennsylvania and eventually became a high school principal and activities director at Haines High School. He now serves as the executive director of the Alaska School Activities Association, a body that oversees and coordinates school sports and activities at different levels all across the state. And thanks to you for being with us today, Gary.
It's my pleasure.
Well, gentlemen, I think maybe the best way to start this conversation is to ask each of you to tell us all a little bit about what some of the upsides might be for kids when they do get involved with sports, whether it's competitive or at some sort of intramural or fun sort of level. And Gary, since I'm sitting right next to you, I'd like to kind of put that to you first.
I'll be happy to start. Thank you very much. Well, we think that activities participation for kids, and this is sports, and I'll also wrap in fine arts and academic activities, are critical in the development of wholesome students and in later on of citizens who are people who we would like to see in our society, strong citizens, ones who make good decisions and raise families and are productive. So we think that our activities programs, not just in Alaska but around the country, do a lot to help develop that with students.
And so how? You know, for someone who maybe has never even heard that concept before, how is it that sports and involvement in sports does that?
Well, for one thing, we can hold kids to higher standards. And so we don't accept the average or the everyday. In order to participate in an activity program, kids have to meet certain criteria, a set of rules that have been adopted by the schools around the state, and they make sense. School boards support them, and they're historically the things that you would consider. Attending the school, of course, keeping the grades up, behaving, and meeting a certain criteria as far as age and making sure that there's a level or consistent playing field across the state. So when one school puts a team on the field and another school does, that they both know that those students have met and will be held to certain criteria, and it's fair. That's the school advantage. For the individual students, though, there are many things that they learn. Learn how to work together, learn how to show up on time, cooperate, follow rules, work hard, try to keep themselves in good physical condition. And in Alaska, we also hold kids to a higher standard in their use of alcohol, drugs, and tobacco. We're one of the few states that actually has a statewide program. It's called Play for Keeps, Win for Life. This is our fourth year, and we're seeing some good results of that. And for years and years, Alaska has led the nation in teen drug use, and that includes tobacco and alcohol. And so our philosophy has been, since kids want to play and sing and dance and debate and travel around to do different things, that they're willing to act better, to hold themselves to a higher standard. And so we've raised the bar for high school kids in Alaska. They all have to be involved in this program now. Any kid who participates, their parents have to be involved. There's certain criteria that they have to follow. It's a statewide program, so it follows a kid from school to school. No longer can a kid do something in one school and then move somewhere else and get away with it, so to speak. No one will know. The kids are on the hook once they start their high school participation for four consecutive years. And we're seeing some, as I mentioned, we're seeing some pretty good results right now. It's still in our early stages or in our fourth year of implementation, but it's a program that is very, really needed in Alaska, and we're happy that we've been able to put it together.
And so kids in Alaska have to meet these criteria that make sure that they're sort of living these clean, healthy lifestyles. And then if they make some bad choices, their sports participation can be affected.
It is. Yes, that's right. And it can be affected. There's a couple ways. They can be suspended from participation. And it's based on the number of times that they've offended the rules in the program. And there also are some really good online educational components, which we've developed, which some of them are optional, some are required in order to return to play.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael Josephson, we've just been listening to Gary Matthews talk about some of the academic benefits, some of the character benefits, and some of the benefits to keeping kids away from some risk behaviors that go along with being a part of competitive sports here in our state. From your perspective, since you look at these issues at a national level, what is your opinion of some of the upsides of playing competitive sports when you're a young person?
Well, first of all, the question, to me at least, gets broken down into sports overall, which, by the way, the evidence is very clear. There's a lot of research that most co-curricular activities, in fact, probably all, but I haven't seen all the studies, that kids get better grades. They have greater connectivity to the school, which is a very important thing. It's called a protective factor for other behaviors. Coaches can have huge influence. And so there's no question that sports overall is beneficial. But when we look at it nationally, it depends a lot on region, sport, and the individual program and coach as to whether, in fact, it's good for an individual. So even in Alaska, I would suppose that there are probably some programs that are better than others. We know, for instance, from our surveys, for example, that and we do some major national surveying, that kids in most sports who play varsity sports cheat in class less than their counterparts, but that's not true for the kids who are playing football or boys basketball or soccer, girls or boys soccer. So it's just interesting. There's certain sports that seem to not do as well as others, but overall, it's a good thing. And honestly, it always depends on the coach. If you have a great coach, I don't care what the sport is, kids will learn wonderful things and come out better human beings. And if you don't have such a very good coach, the rest of the rules don't matter.
Well, Gary Matthews, maybe you can explain a little bit, too, about how Alaska, it seems like Alaska has some uniqueness about its high school sports. I would say in part because in some of the smaller, more rural areas, basketball is huge. It's a huge part of not just the students' lives, but also the lives of the entire community. And then also, we don't have any professional sports teams in our state. And I'm wondering if maybe sometimes that makes those high school games, those young teenage athletes, somehow in a different kind of position of responsibility or focus in a community than they might be in other places where there are more professional or college sports at a greater degree.
Yeah, I'll speak about the high school part first, and I'll talk about collegiate. You're right. We have 200 plus high schools in Alaska, and most of them are in remote communities off of a road system with no land link other than sometimes a boat, sometimes a snow machine, or a flying. Some schools in Southeast Alaska are connected by the state ferry system. And so because of that, the athletic and activity opportunities are rather limited. The only universal sport in Alaska is, as you said, basketball. And every school has some kind of a facility, a gymnasium of some kind. Out of our 200 schools, we only have slightly more than 30 which have hockey, soccer, football. And so those sports are, even though they're pretty popular in the larger communities, statewide don't carry the same popularity. So basketball is the big one. This weekend, this next week, I think you mentioned earlier, we have our March Madness. We have all four classes of basketball, boys and girls. We're going to have 88 basketball games in 6 days at the Sullivan Arena. And this is March Madness Alaska. And so this is the big, the largest event, the most people attending, the most students participating, and so forth in the state. You're right when you said we don't have professional teams. The Alaska Aces is an East Coast hockey team. It's a semi-professional league, I guess you would call it. We don't have intercollegiate football. There are only two states that don't. We're one of them. We don't have Division I basketball in Alaska, and a lot of just nearly every state has Division I basketball. We don't. So some of the influences that you might see in other states aren't evident in Alaska. We have our own problems, as you can imagine, but I don't think they're too near the extent that you'll see in other states.
I think one of the things I want us to stress, though, is not only what sports are doing, but the great opportunity to what more they can do. We brought together a whole lot of sports people from all around and came out with a concept of what we call the teacher coach. And the idea was to be sure that we emphasize the teaching responsibilities of every coach in the same way that you refer to the athlete as a student athlete, and to try to encourage those coaches, and many of them are doing a wonderful job as it is, but you don't have to be sick to get better, to be more self-conscious about using their tremendous influence they have. You know, the average coach has so much more influence than any other high school teacher, because first of all, the kid really wants to be there. He wants what the coach has. He wants the coach's approval, and he wants his playing time. So as a result, that coach has an opportunity to help shape the qualities of that kid in a way that very few others do, at least with adolescents. And we just try to encourage coaches to see that and even expand their skills on it and share best practices and measure their success not so much on how many games they win, but how many really good people they're producing.
Well, let's talk about coaches. You know, what makes a good coach? What are those elements that someone can have or can put forward that make them better than, say, somebody else?
Well, I think, at least from my point of view, and Mr. Matthews may have a different perspective, but the first question is that they're a coach of a sport, so they need to be competent. I think they first need to really understand their sport and be able to help that young person develop their skills within the sport. But in our view, and I think it's the view of most associations, the sport is really just a platform. It's the stage for developing positive life skills, for discipline, for the idea of dealing with failure, for honor above all. Our program in sports is called Pursuing Victory with Honor. And so to us, a good coach is someone who really not only accepts that as part of his role, but really embraces it in an excitement. You know, John Wooden was one of the people who helped us formulate our whole program with Pursuing Victory with Honor and developed the teacher coach. And he loves to tell a story about an old coach named Alonzo Stagg, who used to be a football coach. And he had an undefeated season, and he was asked the question of, was this your best season ever? Was this your best team ever? Excuse me. And his answer was, I won't know that for 20 or 30 years. And I think that the answer is, to me, a good coach is someone who really embraces and is excited and accepts the opportunity he or she has to really help that young person develop the values and habits that will make them a good person. But the good news is actually, I have no data to back this up, but I think the proportion of coaches who are good teacher coaches is higher than the proportion of teachers who are good teachers. Because the kind of person who tends to go into that does love the sport and love kids. They don't always. But so I think by and large, because there are bad teachers too, you know, in any school. But teaching is an art. There's one other thing I just want to point out that's a great benefit of sports if they take advantage of it. It's a real opportunity to also educate parents and to give parents some tools to deal with their kids. And in fact, where sports goes wrong, it's usually in the stands, you know, with spectators and the behaviors. So a good comprehensive sports program has an opportunity to really be educating the parents as to good expectations as well as the kids.
Mm-hmm. So both of you have made really interesting cases for why, you know, good coaches can really have a long and lasting impact for the positive on kids. Is there sort of the converse of that? Like, if you have a bad coach, does that make an even worse impact than say, someone who's kind of in between, a neutral person? Maybe, Michael Josephson, you might have some information about that from
evidence. Yeah, sure. Look, a bad coach can teach kids to cheat. You know, a bad coach can can teach by either modeling or overtly to be bad losers, you know, to be bad sports, to use anger, that to scream. I mean, when you look at all the bad behavior that you see in sports is just life with the volume turned up high in a way. And so you see all of the things in life and you'll see in sports. Well, what you allow, you encourage. And so there are many situations where I think bad coaches have a very bad influence, not only on the young people, but on the organizations that they have. And that's why it's the responsibility of the people who hire those coaches, even if they're volunteer coaches in a little league, to really have high standards and say, look, I know we need warm bodies, but we don't need people who are bad influences. You wouldn't hire a babysitter who is going to be a bad influence on your kids. But unfortunately, we're pretty tolerant, even though it's a minority. I think we're awfully tolerant about a lot of these bad coaches.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're talking a little bit as we talk about coaches and qualities and so forth. We're talking about a little bit about character and about some of these positive character building experiences that sports can give young people. Why is it that sports offers more opportunity for that than, say, some other activities kids can be involved with? Michael Josephson.
Well, first of all, I think when properly understood, it's the main topic. I mean, because you're not the percentage of your kids who are going to go beyond whatever level you're teaching them and play even college ball, let alone pro ball, or let alone some of these sports that don't even have professionals, is so small. You say then it's a recreational activity. Why are we having a recreational activity in the context of a school? Is because it is exactly the place where we're trying to build character and positive life skills. Whereas if I'm a history teacher, I got a history curriculum to deal with as well. Secondly, it does it in context, because the best way to build character and the best way to teach values is in the context of actual things, of challenges, of the practice, of dealing with failures or successes, or dealing with controversies and conflicts. So sports is just a phenomenal opportunity for the vigilant teacher to be able to teach, enforce. We use an acronym called TEAM: teach, enforce, advocate, and model. And the idea is, if you want to really instill values, you need these four things. And there isn't a day that you don't have opportunities, from the practice to the game, to be teaching, enforcing, advocating, and modeling good values like trustworthiness, respect, responsibility, fairness, caring. It's all there.
Kids These Days Today is all about kids and sports. Let us know what you think. Write to us at mail@kidsthesedays.org. I'm talking with Gary Matthews and Michael Josephson today. Ask some people, and they'll say, forget skiing or hockey. Alaska's state sport is basketball. Let's take a listen to a basketball game in action now. Now, you may have heard an unusual sound in that game, one that you might not recognize as going along with basketball. You may have heard wheels. That's because these sounds come to us from a game of wheelchair basketball. Played as part of the Paralympic Sports Alaska program, a program designed to let athletes with physical disabilities get in on Alaska's basketball craze and other sports. It's different from Special Olympics, which is for kids with developmental disabilities. KTD contributor Jessica Cochran recently spoke with high schooler and Paralympic athlete Dalton Dietrich and Dave Poulin, a Paralympic coach and adapted PE teacher for the Anchorage School District.
So just a little bit of the details. The after-school program is the Paralympic Sports Alaska program.
Correct.
And how recent is it?
It's been a partnership between Anchorage School District and Challenge Alaska for 3 years now. A lot of people don't know what para means in the word Paralympic. Para means along with. So along with all the other athletics that are happening in the Anchorage School District, this is just another sporting opportunity. And just like a coach for a basketball team at West High gets paid, I get paid as a coach for the Paralympic program.
Okay. So when did you first meet Dalton? Or Dalton, when did you first meet Dave? Let's do it that way.
I first met Dave when, how old was I? I think I was...
Was I 12?
Yeah. I was 12 years old, and I had basically just quit gymnastics because it wasn't quite working out. Because for several years, I tried to do sports with all the other kids. Like in grade school, I would be miles behind everyone else when we were running and stuff, and I couldn't climb rope. And then I tried to do baseball, got hit with the ball more times than I can count. And then I moved on to gymnastics, and I have good upper body strength and stuff. Like I can do parallel bars and I can hold myself up for a long time, but my core strength and my leg strength isn't that great. So, like, while everyone else was walking on their hands, I was kind of off in a corner somewhere, in a way. And then I heard about this awesome opportunity of sports for kids with disabilities, and I know the extents of my disabilities, and I kind of knew them back then, but the cool thing is that since then, since I've ever started this program, I found out that I can do a lot more than I could a couple of years ago and stuff.
And so tell me about the two events that are done in Anchorage in the Paralympic program. Dalton, do you want to tell me about them?
So we have both wheelchair basketball and also wheelchair soccer. And wheelchair soccer, it's for this program, it's actually an adaptation of the Paralympic sport power soccer for people that are bound to a electrically motor-powered wheelchair, such as people with muscular dystrophy. That's a great sport, and it's just like general soccer, all the same fouls and everything. It's just some of the movements that we do may be different.
We actually have soccer guards that attach to both manual all-court chairs and the power chairs. The soccer ball is a 14-inch soccer ball, and the sport is played on a basketball court, and it's 4-on-4. Like Dalton said, basically same rules. Instead of a throw-in, some of our athletes can't use their upper body, especially the ones in a motorized chair. So we have kick-ins instead of a throw-in. But it's 4-on-4, it's a fast-paced game, and it's a lot of fun.
Wheelchair basketball, though, even though I'm not the best at shooting baskets, I still think it's my favorite sport out of the two, because it requires a lot of team coordination, hand-eye coordination, and I'm pretty good at getting the team like to focus if we're getting beat every once in a while, either me or one of the mentors will kind of get the team to focus up, and I'll try to get people to do court maneuvers, such as things like we call the three-man weave, but a lot of times people who aren't so involved with sports, and this is the only sports activity that they get, or I don't know, sometimes it's just the time of the day, but they can't always remember, oh yeah, we're doing this specific maneuver, because they're just kids. Generally, most of the kids we're working with, the able-bodied ones, they're just in middle school. I just love the people I meet, because I meet some really cool people that are in this program, other people with physical disabilities, and I've become pretty good friends with them, and we talk to each other on a regular basis on Facebook when we find each other and stuff. But wheelchair basketball, it's the one thing I look forward to after a long day at school.
You know, you brought up a good point. And if you think about it, our kids with physical disabilities forever, at least in this state until this program started, they really never participated on a team. So the whole concept of teamwork and camaraderie is brand new to them. So now we've got an established team, and the coaches are concentrating on the skills and drills. And now that we're established and we have leaders amongst the group, such as Dalton, now Dalton is the captain, and he's going to be working on those social aspects, which is so normal and done with every other sport that's out there. But this is brand new to us for this population that we're serving. So it's exciting to see that we're basically doing what everyone else is doing. And again, para along with all the other sports that are out there. we're doing it. So it's exciting.
So this is it's a competitive sports league. Who do you compete against? Do you divide up into teams and stick with those teams for the season, or how does that work?
Good question.
We basically scrimmage against ourselves every night because, again, we're trying as hard as we can to get the word out there, but we still can't get enough people to come because our main targets are other kids with physical disabilities, but numbers are so few still that most of the kids that we have show up are those from the school we're being hosted by, Central Middle School. And I would die to get like another team from like out of Alaska or even somewhere off in like Juneau if they ever created one to come up here, because that's what I'm looking for. Is I'm looking for serious competition and something to actually compete for something in.
And basically, it's a unique thing that we've got going on. This is a district-wide program. As of right now, it's co-ed, and it's only for secondary age students. Anchorage is the biggest city in Alaska. We're the first ones. We're in talks with some APE teachers in Fairbanks and Kenai and even Matsu, and they're starting to get something formed. So hopefully, maybe in a few years, there'll be some teams within the state that we can compete with. One of the difficulties is that there's no travel money outside of the state, and all of the wheelchair basketball teams and wheelchair soccer teams are in the lower 48. And for us to go to a regional competition would require a lot of money. However, the ultimate goal is to eventually get to a point where we could do some fundraising, go down there, and that's where the college scouts are. And ultimately, one of my personal goals as an adaptive PE teacher is to get a kid to earn himself an athletic scholarship to go to college with a physical disability, which now there's about 20 universities that do that. So that's the big picture.
I've been speaking with adapted sports teacher Dave Poulin and Paralympic athlete and basketball team captain Dalton Dietrich. Thank you both so much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you.
The Paralympic Sports Alaska Wheelchair Soccer Program starts this week from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday through Thursday at Central Middle School. Next week, the U.S. Adaptive Alpine Skiing Championships are being held at Alyeska, featuring some of the best mono skiers and chair skiers in the country. Well, this is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Today we're talking about kids and sports. We'll hear more from our guests later this hour. Also, still coming up, we'll learn about how young Alaskans can be sporting and compete by flexing their brain muscles versus those in their arms and legs. Stay with us. We'll be back after the break. We're back. We're talking about kids and youth sports today on Kids These Days. I'm speaking with Michael Josephson from the Josephson Institute. He's an author, commentator, and sought-after ethicist. He joins us by phone from Los Angeles. In the studio with me in Anchorage is Executive Director of the Alaska Schools Activities Association, Gary Matthews. And thanks again to both of you for being here today. And let's continue our conversation about sports and kids. And I'd like to maybe start off by asking a little bit about something that's maybe not so positive to talk about. And that's that in professional sports, you know, there's a lot of news out there about a lot of things going on, but whenever there's an issue with performance-enhancing drugs, that certainly makes headlines. And I'm wondering, when it comes to young kids who are involved in sports and maybe see themselves aspiring toward a professional career, are kids starting to get involved with performance-enhancing drugs when they're so young and when they're still in high school sports? Is that happening?
In Alaska, the information is not readily available. Senator Hollis French worked on a initiative a few years ago, and we were involved in that and some other some coaches. In fact, one of the football coaches in Anchorage at one of the high schools was a member of this group. And during that time, he admitted that when he was in high school and in college, he was using steroids. Hmm. And that was quite an admission because it came out of the blue. And it became a very emotional interview when he was involved in that. But there has been some emphasis in Alaska. It has not received the attention that nearly other many other states has. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we have so many remote villages. Football and hockey are, and soccer, in fact, all three, are rather limited as far as numbers of kids around the state and school that sponsor those activities. I don't think we have quite as much problem with performance-enhancing drugs in Alaska. We have a lot of problems with alcohol and other types of illegal drugs, tobacco, but I don't think the performing-enhancing things are of the magnitude that we may see in other states.
And Michael Josephson, is this a growing concern on a national level, or is it something that sort of stays the same? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a little hard to tell. Clearly, it apexed somewhat when all of the baseball steroids, you know, stories came out with the Bobby Bonds and the Roger Clemens and the like. And so as a result, just even then to realize the very high percentage, at least according to these other players, the high percentage of their colleagues who have used steroids certainly suggests that probably has worked its way down. There are some states that even have drug testing policies. I think the likelihood of a kid taking something like steroids is two factors. One, accessibility, and the interesting thing is a lot of your kids are remote, so it may be less accessible, but the internet has connected people in ways that have made things easier to get. But the other thing is how intense they are about the sport. I mean, so when a kid thinks he's going to go to a D1 college and get a scholarship and the steroids are going to make him stronger and bigger, he's far more likely to take the steroids than if he's in, you know, tennis or cross country or other kinds of sports. So I think a lot of it depends on sort of the role that sports is playing in that young person's life. It's very important, though, that we teach kids about that. I mean, we don't know for sure what the percentage is, but we know that kids are taking cocaine. We know that they're taking ecstasy. We know that, you know, kids are kids and they're smoking marijuana. We have to put it all together about there are some things that are really very, very unhealthy, and we got to do what we can to educate them about it. We want to be sure that the adults are protecting them from it, and we also want to be certain that there's some mechanism by which we do from time to time find out whether this is occurring. And a lot of it is to talk to former athletes. And so if this fellow says, you know, look, I used to when I was a kid, I bet you talked to him, he wasn't the only one. So we got to accept that it's happening and take it very seriously. In sports, there's two reasons, and we got to emphasize this with kids, that performance-enhancing drugs shouldn't be used. One is the clear one is it's unhealthy. That's why it's illegal. If it were healthy, it wouldn't be illegal. But it is unhealthy. But because it's unhealthy and because it's illegal, it's also cheating. So for both the idea of you being a cheater and what happens to you and your reputation if you're caught cheating, and we have many stories of Olympians and others who've really destroyed their lives by this use of performance-enhancing drugs and the health risks.
You mentioned, Michael Josephson, that a kid who sees, you know, potential in his future to maybe go on to college or go on to an illustrious sports career, that person might even be more tempted to take performance-enhancing drugs. You know, a kid who's really dedicated to his or her sport, who's really motivated to improve and better oneself and so forth, you know, irrespective of performance-enhancing drugs and ways of cheating, there are other things that kids are known to do and athletes in general are known to do. And, you know, overtraining is something that gets some attention, especially because, you know, kids can get injuries that will affect them lifelong when this kind of thing happens. I'm wondering, can you explain, I'll start with you, Michael Josephson, a little bit about this phenomenon of overtraining and, you know, what is it, why is it happening with kids? Why are kids making choices to practice so much that they're hurting themselves?
Well, first of all, I can't think of a single case of overtraining that I know about that wasn't connected to a coach who was either requiring it or inducing it or encouraging it. So the kids tend to do what they think they need to do for the coach, and that's why it's important to know there's always an adult involved. Mm-hmm. And overtraining can be everything from just misplaced thinking, well, I'm just conditioning them and it's really good for them, and not realizing when is enough or when is enough too much, to some people who are just obsessive and excessivist and they use the kids as just a vehicle for their own glory, that they're not really in it as teachers, they're in it to win and to be glorified. But overtraining is a function of an overly zealous or an ignorant coach, and by ignorant I don't mean he's a stupid person, I just mean he may not be realizing the dangers or the damage and the things that he's doing. He just probably thinks he's doing a good thing for the kids.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just like jump in on that also. I think, I agree with what you said, Mr. Josephson. I think that we can also lay some of the blame, if you want to speak, call it that, on the feet of parents who are have some dream or an illusion that their kids are going to be world-class athletes, and that and someone says they're living their lives through their students, their children, and I think we see that, and that's one of the, I see that when I have two grandsons who played youth hockey, and I could see that every day in the youth hockey community. So I think that parents need to understand that a balance is important, and that kids need to be kids. They need to do other things than constantly play a sport or work out or try to improve their physical abilities. They need to have a chance to do other things, to expand their mental capabilities, to try other things, to just have fun. And so I think that parents need to understand that they're not doing their kids a great favor when they overemphasize participation.
All of these club sports, if you're good at something, you end up playing it year-round. When I was growing up, you'd play all the sports. You know, the season was football season, you'd play football. The season was baseball, you'd play baseball. Right now, kids are beginning to specialize at very young ages, and they take the extra coaching and the extra camps, and it's a pity in a way because they miss the grand experience. But that's almost become a cultural thing where parents are in conspiracy with coaches and kids, and it's all of a sudden that they're a baseball player and they see themselves as a baseball player pretty early in life.
Mm-hmm. Fellows, I'd like to transition just a little bit in our subject and talk a little bit about girls and competitive sports. There are, you know, current issues sort of wrapped around this when it comes to fairness of availability for sports that kids, that young girls can compete in. But then there's also, you know, some evidence, for example, that supports that, especially when girls are involved in sports, that it can mean some really positive things for girls. At the Women's Sports Foundation, that's a website, womensportsfoundation.org, I found a list of some of the health and well-being benefits that come to girls when they're involved in sports, such as there's less likely to be unintended pregnancy and higher grades for girls who compete in sports, that 4 hours of exercise a week can help reduce a girl's risk later of breast cancer to up to 60%, and that there's higher levels of self-confidence, self-esteem, and lower levels of depression in women and girls who play sports. And sort of, you know, this list of benefits goes on. And I wondered if either of you guys could, or both of you guys could comment specifically about how competitive sports have helped girls and young women.
Well, I have four daughters. And as it happens, two of them have been sports involved, and two of them wouldn't sweat if, you know, you forced them to, but they're in drama and singing and the like. So the first thing I say is I think kids need to have the opportunity. Girls need the opportunity to have sports. And if it's an educational thing, we need to provide that opportunity to them. I don't think we want to force it like saying, if you're not in sports, it's a bad thing. But there is no question about it. But a lot of those data that you have, which are very good data, are also true with almost any good co-curricular activity, not necessarily the physical data about that. But so I love sports for girls. I think it's important that we provide it. I don't think we want to be any more coercive about that than any other activity, but we sure ought to support it, and they need to have the opportunities. And if we really think it's healthy for the kid, how do we justify giving it to one gender and not the other?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Gary Matthews.
When I was a student myself, and then when I started teaching, there were no girls' sports. There were no possibilities of girls' sports in either Pennsylvania or Alaska at the high school level. There were some club activities. Only thing girls could do when I started teaching in Haines was be a cheerleader or be in the drill team. That was it. There were no athletic activities. And that was a kind of an unfortunate restraint on the girls who really wanted to do those things. And I can remember when basketball started for girls, there were 6 people on the team. Only some of them could run down the court. Girls weren't supposed to sweat, as Mr. Josephson said. That was, he thought, would be unladylike. And so things have changed a lot since then. In Alaska, we have essentially the same number of girl participants as we do boys in our activities programs, and which is, I think, very good. It's been improving. We encourage girls' participation, but no more than we do boys. I think that what we don't want is any barriers for girls' participation, and let the girls sort it out. Let the chips fall, so to speak, and let them fully participate. And we have a couple unusual things in Alaska. One, we had the first high school girl ever to win a state wrestling championship against a boy at the largest school classification division. That happened about 5 years ago, and it happened again this year. And so we've had 2 girls state champions wrestling against boys. We still have some people out there who don't think girls should wrestle against boys. We have some schools who won't let their boys, these are private schools, won't let their boys wrestle against girls or vice versa. And that's an item for another discussion sometime.
What haven't we talked about this hour that's important in terms of a discussion about youth and competitive sports?
Well, I'll start off. I think one of the things that is very important this time of year, it's probably happening all over the country as school districts are looking at paring budgets and deciding priorities and whether they're going to give raises or whether they're going to expand programs or reduce staff, reduce activities, participation opportunities for kids. I think it's important for people to pause for a second and think, and this is my point, the proven benefits of participating in intergalactic activities for kids have some value. The benefits have a value, and it would be a false economy, so to speak, to say, let's start reducing these opportunities for kids because of tough financial times. Many school districts in Alaska now require students to pay to play. That's not universal around the country at all, but it's becoming more and more popular in Alaska. More and more a practice in Alaska because of the financial realities. But I think that the small percentage of a school district budget that goes into the activities cost, participation, travel, coaches, stipends, sports equipment, and so forth, is well worth digging down into the pocket to make sure that these programs continue. And Alaska's better off than most states economically right now, but we still have our pockets of areas where these people are looking at these programs. And when it comes down to priorities, I hope that priority number one can be programs for kids, which includes the academic, the fine arts, of course, the classroom programs, and the ability and the opportunity to expand their growth through activities participation.
Well, and I endorse that. I just think, though, that sometimes the sports do have a little bit of obligation to at least prove that they are not just recreation, that they're not just the toy department. When sports are done right, they are part of education, and they have every bit as much place to be there. So I think that in that sense, the sports has the obligation to be able to show that in tough budget times. I just also want to say we have a website, charactercounts.org, And lots of tools there for parents and lots of tools for the kids. I hope they'll find we have surveys that you can take. The more you think about this, the more thoughtful you are, the better at it you can get. And we have a motto, you don't have to be sick to get better. And we'd like to see coaches become better coaches. We'd like to see parents become better at being good sports parents. And there are a lot of tools that they can do that, and we invite them to our website for that.
And we will link directly to charactercounts.org and to your other websites that we've mentioned today on the program.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank Gary Matthews and Michael Josephson both for being on Kids These Days today.
Well, it was a pleasure to be with you. I loved it. Thank you very much.
It's been an honor, and I'm happy to be able to come over here and share some thoughts with the people of Alaska.
Today on the program, we've talked a lot about how kids can be active on the court, on the field, and elsewhere. We've learned about what can be gained through taking part in competitive sports, teamwork, healthy habits, that sort of thing. Now let's think about how those things could be applied to all kinds of sports that we do in our head. Puzzles, problem solving, math problems, computer programming. In Alaska, lots of young people are involved with the FIRST LEGO League. FIRST stands for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology. FIRST LEGO League activities are aimed at getting kids of all ages excited about learning and competing. Rebecca Parks is a science, technology, engineering, and math education specialist with the Juneau Economic Development Council, or JEDC. JEDC coordinates FIRST LEGO League activities statewide. She recently spoke with me about this competitive, sports-like program.
FIRST, the nonprofit, is a national program that actually has a worldwide reach. In Alaska, we actually have the highest per capita participation in both the FIRST LEGO League and the FIRST Tech Challenge at the high school level. So it's been really popular and really successful here. FIRST LEGO League is a great program because it can be integrated into classrooms. It can also be done at a community center. It can be part of a Boys and Girls Club, a Girl Scout team. We've had teams at churches through homeschool, or just a group of friends that want to do something really cool with their spare time. In the classroom, it's usually picked up by a teacher who wants to offer something a little bit different to her students. And it touches on communication skills, building skills, mechanical engineering, IT ideas, computer programming, and general creativity and innovation. And that's one of the things as an economic development group that we really love about it. It gives kids so much room to think about all the things that they could be doing. The organization was started by Dean Kamen and Woody Flowers. So Dean Kamen, famous inventor, is all about finding solutions to things. And Woody Flowers is a teacher at MIT. And they were sort of looking at the U.S.'s declining economy, or declining role in the worldwide economy. And they were looking at what we were doing really well as a nation. And they saw professional sports and they said, well, if our kids are aspiring to do that and that's what they're putting their time and energy to, we need to take what the professional side of that is doing and put it into science and technology, because that's where our success and our growth is going to come from. And so they did that. They made a sports competition that was just as much fun and just as inspiring, and they wanted to build the role models in that group to be just as revered as our sports stars are. So you'll see when you go to the national competition, Dean Kamen walks in a room, and it's like Michael Jordan just walked in. It is amazing how much these kids want to become like the role models in the program are, and it's fun to see. One of the quotes is that it's the one sport where everybody can become a professional. It's not like basketball where there's that really, really elite cadre of high school athletes that can go on and do it for the rest of their lives. If you get involved with engineering, if you just get involved with the problem solving that's in that middle school program, it's something that you will always have the opportunity to be involved with, and you can be a professional and you can make your living out of it. The other great thing about FIRST is that there is an opportunity for everybody to be involved. It's a program that you can start with in kindergarten, and it'll carry you all the way through high school, and then hopefully you can get a scholarship and go on to college, go on to get an associate's degree, or be in an apprenticeship program. So that youngest program is the Junior FIRST LEGO League, and that has no bottom age limit. and can go up, kids build a model and do a research project and really just start to think about the engineering process and enjoy that playing with a purpose. The next step up is the first Lego League, and the bottom age limit, 9 years old, is a soft limit, and it goes up to 14. So it's 9 to 14-year-olds, and that's where they build this Lego robot and program it, and that turns into a real competition where they come and there's ways to compete against other teams. At the high school level, there's both the first tech challenge, which is a smaller version. The robots can be, I think it's 18 inches by 18 inches, and they compete on a 12-foot square field, and there are four robots on the field at a time. And that's the one that's become really popular in Alaska because you have teams of 3 to 10 kids. The next level up is the first robotics challenge, where the kids compete on a field that's about the size of a basketball court, and the robots are bigger, everything's a bit more complicated, and that again is for high school age kids. And then all those programs lead into the first scholarship program that gives opportunities in higher education. Each year for the first Lego League challenge, the teams have to come up with two products. So one thing is they'll design and program a robot to complete missions on a 4 foot by 8 foot table. The second part is they actually do a project, and some people call it a research project. I don't like to do that because it's really about finding a solution, not just researching a problem. FIRST actually has a patent project to encourage FIRST LEGO League teams to actually pursue patents for their ideas, and I know there are at least two teams of 9 to 14-year-olds in Alaska that are looking at the patent process and considering putting in applications.
Can you explain how the sort of, you know, robot on the table part of the project interacts or is connected to that research or solution portion that you're talking about?
Sure. Well, the missions on the table are designed around that theme, and they're meant to give teams an idea of what they could do research on, problems that are out there that they could find solutions to. But then also, that's the hook. That's, for me, what I first saw and said, oh man, this is fun. Like, I get to play with Legos and build a small bot that goes out and travels around this table. But they're usually about a dozen missions, and it forces the teams to look at bigger problem-solving strategies on what are we going to be able to accomplish in the 2.5 minutes that our robot has to go out and complete missions. So most teams aren't going to go and try and complete every single mission. They're just going to pick a few that they have a plan for that they think they can pre-program their robot to finish and accomplish in that time limit. At the tournament, they have four different sessions that they'll go to. One is their robot performance, and that's going out and actually running the missions, that 2.5 minutes that they can score points on the table. Another is their robot design presentation. So they'll meet with a panel of judges and actually have to discuss their robot, show their programming, and it's to work on communication skills, make sure that the kids actually understand what they've done. It's all focused on kids doing the work, making sure that the coaches and the mentors aren't over-involved in building and programming the robot. So the kids will go through and talk about everything they did, talk about why they made changes that they did, and discuss the engineering process that they went through. There's also the project presentation. So that's looking at their innovation, again, focused on communication skills. They'll usually have some documentation of what they did, so they're getting writing skills in there too. And then they're always going through a question and answer, just again to check that the kids really understand what they're doing. Then there's a final section that's just on teamwork. And each team will go into a room with another panel of judges, and they'll get a small challenge that's a teamwork challenge. And the judges are going to look at not necessarily whether or not they complete the challenge, but how well they work together to come up with their solution, to make sure that it's also they're pulling the best ideas from the group. And with that is this idea that's woven through the program of gracious professionalism and the FIRST LEGO League core values, making sure that even though it's a competition and kids definitely come in wanting to win, they want to win because their design is the best. If your robot's going to win in that last competition, you want it to beat a really good robot. You want to know that it's because of the hard work you put in, and you want to do everything you can to help the other teams so that that win feels that much better. It's something that the designers of the program tweaked a bit from professional sports to say, we want to make sure that these kids are embracing a different kind of competitiveness that's going to bring everybody up a level. If people are interested in getting involved, starting a team, being a coach, or volunteering at a tournament, there are tons of opportunities to do that. If you want someone to come out to your community and just share the program and see if you're more interested.
Thanks very much, Rebecca Parks, for talking with Kids These Days today. Rebecca says she's available by phone and by email. We have her contact information on our website now, and we'll link to the Alaska and National First LEGO League Robotics websites from kidsthesedays.org for your easy one-click trip for more information. In the meantime, here's a little taste of what FLL competitions sound like. Here's a winning high school student-built robot from last year's Robot Rendezvous First LEGO League and First Tech Challenge competition. Well, that's it for Kids These Days today. Thanks for listening and for being a part of the community. The conversation is finished here for the day, but it keeps on going online all the time. Visit kidsthesedays.org to listen to this program again or share it with friends. You can sign up for a podcast there. You'll also be able to read recent essays by our many regular kidsthesedays.org bloggers. You'll find new postings by Daddy Dynamic, KTD on the Go, and Love and Emotion each week and every week on our homepage. And now it's really, really easy to comment on what you see and read at kidsthesedays.org. Sign into our site using the Facebook username and password you already have. You asked, we answered. We've simplified this process for you. And also, we have like buttons now. It's very cool. Our web content is managed and edited by the one and only Sarah Gonzalez. She also produced today's show. Jessica Cochran reported from Anchorage. Mind Over Matthew composed and performed our theme music. I'm your host, Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.
Kids These Days!